My name is David McIntosh. I'm National Co-Chairman of the Federalist Society, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the Society's Conference on the Presidency and Congress, Constitutionally Separated and Shared Powers. 200 years ago, when the 13 British colonies established their independence from England, the American people set about forming a democratic government that would protect individual freedom. Central to our new scheme of government was the revolutionary concept that political power must be divided between three branches, each serving as a check on the other. Today, as we see people around the world, and especially in Eastern Europe, freeing themselves from colonial rule, the subject of separation of powers is all the more important. Just as this separation of powers has preserved American freedom for over 200 years, it is a vital part of these people's efforts to form for themselves new and democratic governments that will, we hope, protect their hard-won freedoms. I hope you enjoy the conference. I trust that the speakers here will educate us all about the nature and importance of separation of powers. And now to introduce the conference's co-chairman, here is Federalist Society Director Spence Abraham.
Thank you very much. As one of the people who was active in the Federalist Society when we first began a few years ago, it's of course very exciting and gratifying to see such a great turnout as it seems each of our conferences produce. And I'd like to thank all of you who are here for making the investment to come and be with us and to help to broaden the Society's operations and activities. It's my pleasure today to introduce our conference co-chairman, Dick Thornburgh. I think probably everybody here knows Dick's background. Of course, he was a U.S. attorney and a former assistant attorney general of the United States. He was twice elected the governor of Pennsylvania, and of course, since 1988, has served as the 76th attorney general of the United States. Attorney General Thornburgh is no stranger to the Federalist Society. A little over a month after he was confirmed in the position of attorney general, he spoke to the Society's Conference on Criminal Law. There he stressed the need for the vigorous enforcement of the criminal law, especially in the war on drugs. Since then, it has become clear just how important Attorney General Thornburgh is to the Bush-Quayle administration. And this is particularly true in the area of separation of powers. President Bush is committed to assuring that the president be able to exercise the executive power vigorously, which some distinguished panelists may tell us later has been eroded by congressional encroachment. The president relies upon the attorney general to guard his constitutional authorities and vigorously defend them in the courts of the United States. He does so daily in the war on drugs when he sends American troops to apprehend General Noriega, and when he resists the irresponsible legislation through the judicial use of the veto power. Attorney General Thornburgh has led the Department of Justice efforts to provide vital support for the president in all of these actions. He has, along with the White House Counsel Shop, set up a new committee of general counsels, which brings together all of the general counsels of the agencies and departments to ensure that the executive branch is coordinated on legal issues. Nowhere is the Attorney General's support for presidential authority more important than in the field of foreign affairs and in the President's duties as Commander-in-Chief. The Attorney General provides legal backup for the military's efforts to end terrorism and drug trafficking. The most recent example, of course, being the successful apprehension of General Noriega in Panama. On a daily basis, under his leadership, the Justice Department has vigorously resisted encroachment upon the president's powers. Now, protecting the president's power and pursuing his agenda in the courts is not always popular, especially with those who would prefer to exercise that power themselves. So I think it's quite clear that Dick Thornburgh plays a vital role, and I know the administration values that role very, very deeply. Every American who cares about the separation of powers as a check on abuses of government knows that Attorney General Dick Thornburgh's struggle is a noble one. For in the long run, when the dust settles and the next generation looks back on this administration and its record in defense of executive power, they will say that Attorney General Thornburgh stood with the founding fathers in resisting the temptation to pursue the immediate end in favor of preserving the more fundamental balance between the branches. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce to you a good friend and a great American, Attorney General Dick Thornburgh.
Thank you very much, Spence. It's a personal privilege for me to bask in the warmth of your introduction at the same time that I extend an official welcome to you to Washington. We go back a number of years, and I read of your attachment to the Vice President's staff with a great deal of satisfaction and pleasure. It's also good to be here with those of you who are involved in and supportive of the work of the Federalist Society. You were kind enough, really, to extend me an official welcome shortly after I came to Washington in the fall of 1988. And it's a great pleasure to return once more and share with you some views. I continue, I believe, in a great tradition of support and interest in your activities. Both of my immediate predecessors, Bill Smith and Ed Meese, were strong supporters and active participants in the programs that you carry on. And that is a tradition I am pleased to see perpetuated. Last fall, I had the unique opportunity to be the first Attorney General of the United States to undertake an historic dialogue on the rule of law and human rights with those leaders in the Soviet Union charged with responsibility for law enforcement and the administration of justice. Our week-long visit to Moscow, at the invitation of the Soviet Minister of Justice, afforded us the chance to range over a wide variety of subjects central to what makes our democracy work: our Bill of Rights, our federal system, our two-party political process, and most important, the principle of separation of powers embodied in our Constitution. It was perhaps this last, the concept of the separation of powers, that most confounded our Soviet hosts. It seemed almost to be a distraction from their apparently sincere effort to fashion what President Mikhail Gorbachev has described as his ultimate aspiration, a law-based state. To the Russian officials, judges, law professors, and students with whom we exchange views, the concept of purposely building in a constructive tension between separate branches of government, our concept of checks and balances, was at the least puzzling and at the most incomprehensible. Accustomed to their own monolithic system, they would surely have to struggle to understand Justice Brandeis's observation that we adopted the separation of powers in 1787, not to avoid friction, but by means of the inevitable friction incident to the distribution of government powers among the branches, to save the people from autocracy. We in this nation, on the other hand, too often take for granted those principles which are truly at the heart of our democratic process. So your focus this weekend on the separation of powers serves the dual purpose of sharpening our own focus on these principles and at the same time highlighting some unique aspects of our system that might yet be emulated by the new democracies in Eastern Europe, and who knows, perhaps in the Soviet Union itself. Let me then offer a brief present-day lawyer's view on separation of powers here in the United States. As lawyers, we have been educated and trained in the value of process. As much as we may be committed to the idea of preserving individual liberties, we know that the only bulwark that will truly protect those precious liberties is process. The rights and freedoms of all citizens are only as secure as the system established to protect them is strong. For instance, even the Soviet Union has a document that purports to establish rights for its citizens, like our own Bill of Rights. The fact that the document obviously has not done so, that the Soviets are now turning to us for legal advice on how to make any such guarantee of rights work, should tell us something. What I believe it tells us is that separation of powers, just as Montesquieu and Locke and Madison argued, is the surest protection for individual liberty in a system of secured democracy. Today, I fear that system is a little less secure, a little less strong than it once was and ought to be. The principle of separation of powers is being threatened. The danger is not yet such that there is an imminent risk either to our liberties or our security. And we may not yet have reached the point which Madison envisioned, where, and I quote, "The legislative department is everywhere extending the sphere of its activity and drawing all power into its impetuous vortex." Does sound a little familiar, I must say. But it is appropriate to note that if Congress's increasing tendency to encroach upon the power of the executive branch continues, it ultimately could threaten both our liberties and our security. And even if there are not as yet serious problems, Congress's increasing tendency to interfere with executive power has in itself made it much harder for the executive to fulfill its responsibilities. Before providing you with some examples of how and where I believe the Congress has encroached on the president's constitutional power, I'd like to make a couple of general observations about my personal philosophy regarding the separation of powers. I'm not one who believes that there is no room for coordination and consultation between the executive and legislative branches, nor am I one who always believes that there is a clear line of power that can be drawn between the two branches. In fact, I tend to believe that it may be a good thing that we do not know precisely where those lines fall, because there is not always certainty as to how far the executive and legislative branches may operate and still remain within their proper spheres. There is a strong incentive for the branches to work together, to compromise their differences. Neither branch is enthusiastic about litigating the scope of its powers when defeat, either way, can represent a much greater loss of power than would any compromise. Nevertheless, there is a strong tendency in each branch, ambition confronting ambition, as Madison proposed, to try to garner as much power for itself as the other branches will allow. Relations between the executive and legislative branches thus often resemble a game of constitutional brinksmanship. At the very brink, rather than resort to the courts, both branches rely principally on the checks and balances established 200 years ago. Those structural mechanisms, however, do not always suffice to resolve modern controversies, which can linger on in unwanted legislation lawfully passed by the Congress, but lastingly opposed by the executive. I'm particularly concerned that today's legislative process has rendered the presidential veto a less effective check on congressional encroachments than was envisioned two centuries ago. It is often very difficult for the president to veto legislation that contains sometimes blatantly unconstitutional provisions. For example, Congress has become fond of inserting substantive provisions in appropriations bills. This is what they call making the provision veto-proof. The president is put in the virtually impossible situation of having to veto an important appropriations bill that may authorize desperately needed funds. It's no exaggeration to say that in these cases, Congress often gives the President the distasteful option of approving an unconstitutional provision buried in an appropriation, or vetoing the entire bill and shutting the entire government down. This has been particularly troublesome in recent years because of the Congress's difficulty in passing funding measures, sometimes until the very last minutes of the session. The net result is that the President's veto, arguably the most powerful weapon in his arsenal to preserve and protect his executive authority, is rendered inoperative. This legislative finagling around the President's veto also indirectly undermines our own liberties. Constitutionally, the President is accountable to all the people. The chief reason the framers made the executive unitary. But how can he account for himself fully to the people when his power is so circumvented by Congress that he may not veto provisions threatening his power or our liberties? Congress is also increasingly attempting to micromanage the executive branch on matters such as foreign affairs, routine executive branch operations, and even the internal deliberations that are solely within the providence of the executive. For example, the President last year had to veto a joint resolution that would have prohibited the export of certain technology and services in connection with the co-development and co-production of the FSX aircraft with Japan. This resolution contained a number of constitutional wrongs. There was, however, one thread that united them. Each sought to hamstring the President's constitutional authority to negotiate with a foreign power. First, the resolution would have infringed upon the President's constitutional authority to define the scope and nature of negotiations with a foreign state. In the conduct of negotiations with foreign governments, it is imperative that the United States speak with one voice. Under Article 2, that voice must be the President's. But Congress added insult to infringement by language that would have required the Defense Department to consult with the Commerce Department on negotiations, and that the Secretary of Commerce make recommendations to the President. Congress, in effect, tried to force the President to renegotiate the FSX deal by requiring him to heed what his own Secretary of Commerce said to do about it. Even today, the President's flexibility to act with dispatch to help our friends in Panama is hampered and delayed by similar congressional caveats. They were impetuously passed in the mirror image of the infamous Boland Amendment to stop any foreign aid or military support or tariff relief from ever going to General Manuel Noriega. Now Noriega is in a Miami jail because of prompt executive action. But those regs are still on the books, blocking help to the new regime in Panama, in some cases, for some 45 days. Such provisions constitute clearly inappropriate intrusions by Congress into executive branch management. But they also encroach on the President's authority with respect to internal deliberations incident to the exercise of executive power. The Constitution's vesting of executive power in the President requires that the President exercise supervisory authority and control over the internal deliberations of the executive branch. Essentially, this means that the President must be free to structure the executive branch's decision-making processes as he sees fit. But the lengths to which Congress will sometimes go to intrude on executive decision-making were never more evident than in this provision in last year's appropriation for the Department of Interior. And I quote, "None of the funds available under this title may be used to prepare reports on contacts between employees of the Department of the Interior and members and committees of Congress and their staff." In other words, the Secretary of the Interior could not keep track of what his own employees may have said to congressional staffers, let alone make reports of such contacts that might show up, for example, in a probe into undue influence by interested congressmen on executive decisions. Thus, at the same time, Congress seeks to regulate contacts between and among executive branch agencies and to prohibit the executive branch from regulating its contacts with the legislative branch. You tell me what kind of rationale is being applied there. Such actions clearly erode the president's constitutional responsibility to supervise the affairs of the executive branch as he sees fit. While the Constitution gives Congress a free hand in determining what laws the president will enforce, I do not believe that Congress has unfettered discretion in determining how the executive branch should execute those laws. Let me speak from sad experience. Congressional efforts to prohibit executive agencies from reorganizing or consolidating offices, or to prohibit agencies from expending funds on activities that are clearly a part of the agency's mission, constitute a particularly indefensible interference with the day-to-day management of executive departments. An example. Last year, Congress inserted a provision in a Justice Department appropriations bill designed to prevent the FBI from changing the character of a field office in Butte, Montana. But what overkill! The rider to the bill set forth that no funds could be spent to relocate, reorganize, or consolidate any office, agency, function, facility, station, activity, or any other entity falling under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice. To be sure, the status quo was maintained in Butte for a few more months, but the language cited also delayed the implementation of a recommendation to me from our U.S. attorneys and the head of the criminal division to enhance our effort against organized crime by merging the separate strike force operations into the U.S. attorney's offices, and also prevented the creation of a much needed office of international affairs at our department. Such provisions obviously represent petty politics at their most base. Even worse, however, they prevent the American people from receiving the improvement in services they rightfully demand of their government. If we're going to ask Americans to give larger and larger portions of their paychecks to Uncle Sam, the very least we can do is to provide them benefits and services in the most cost-effective manner available. Congress obviously justifies these and other restrictions on executive branch actions on the ground that they are directly pursuant to the legislative branch's appropriations powers. I have grave doubts, however, that the power of the purse was ever intended to include the power to define our foreign relations, to manage and structure the executive branch decision-making process, to regulate contacts by agencies such as OMB with other agencies, to prohibit the president from requiring that he be notified when a subordinate communicates in his official capacity with a member of Congress, and to require that Congress be notified of all covert activities within 48 hours, even if doing so could threaten or jeopardize American lives. Yet Congress has attempted all of these usurpations, marking a trend that ultimately poses a grave threat to the separation of powers as a protection of our very liberties. If Congress can prevent me from restructuring our department through its control of the purse, then Congress could, at the extreme, conceivably, prevent me from prosecuting the friend of a member of Congress, or even the member himself. And that, my friends, should give us all pause. A final area of concern is Congress's growing penchant for delegating executive power to persons not controlled by the president, a trend that is particularly dangerous to individual liberties. The president, as I noted, is elected by the citizens of all of the states, and to restate the point, is accountable to them in a way that no other elected or appointed official is. Indeed, if the president fails to uphold the laws, if he acts unfaithfully, the American people can and have held him responsible. Therefore, congressional attempts to delegate elsewhere the executive branch's responsibility for executing the laws undermines the direct accountability of the president that is central to the successful operation of our constitutional system. Not only does the president lose power, but the American people may lose protection for their liberties and their freedoms. Let me illustrate by reference to the Office of the Independent Counsel, an institution I am well aware that was given constitutional sanction by the Supreme Court in Morrison v. Olson. Nonetheless, I suggest that that office does raise legitimate concerns over separation of powers, particularly as the independent counsel's unfettered prosecutorial powers touch upon individual liberties. We are all aware of the compelling arguments for good government, indeed the felt need for some modern prescription against executive tyranny that helped create the independent counsel's office. But let me recall to you another form of tyranny that can also arise unsuspected and that comes from the very choices a prosecutor must necessarily make in bringing cases. Robert Jackson, as Franklin D. Roosevelt's Attorney General, warned that this is where the greatest danger of abuse of the prosecuting power lies, a warning Justice Scalia repeated at length and almost verbatim in his dissent in Morrison v. Olson. If the prosecutor is obligated to choose his case, it follows that he can choose his defendants, Jackson warned. Therein is the most dangerous power of the prosecutor, that he will pick people he thinks he should get rather than cases that need to be prosecuted. An attorney general must be acutely sensitive to this danger so that, as Jackson warned, the crime prosecuted does not become that of being attached to the wrong political views or being personally obnoxious to or in the way of the prosecutor himself. If that is so for the Attorney General, how much more sensitive must an independent counsel be, since the Ethics in Government Act automatically focuses his or her prosecutorial actions upon specific members of the executive branch. Indeed, do not the initiating procedures under the Act all but pick the defendant for the independent counsel? I broached this subject in passing, not to impugn any past or present independent counsel, but to point out forthrightly, I hope, present difficulties and potential dangers that arise even from the best of intentions when the separation of powers is ignored, or as in this case, is legislatively gotten around. These dangers clearly derive from the parceling out of executive power by the Congress among the judiciary and the legislature itself to create an office such as the Independent Counsel. In the process, accountability has been confused, the unitary executive further fragmented, and the rights of individuals put in jeopardy by the built-in targeting of prosecutive efforts, not upon prospective offenses, but upon putative defendants. In isolation, many of the incidents I've cited to you this afternoon may not seem overly threatening, but together, I suggest they represent a trend that, if continued, could endanger our very system of government. That system has relied on process to help ensure that individual liberties are preserved, in the main, upon the separation of power, writ large over two centuries ago by the Constitution's framers to minimize the likelihood that individual liberties would be sacrificed to increasingly powerful government. Today's overstepping by the legislative branch does not yet threaten individual liberty, but it does unnecessarily challenge this administration's commitment to a less adversarial relationship between the coequal branches of government. And it is also compromising government's ability to provide services with the care and dispatch our taxpaying citizens expect. As students of the law and of history, we've long understood the importance of separation of powers. We are now poised to share our national experience in developing institutions for implementing the rule of law and defending human rights with those nations in Eastern Europe awakening from their Soviet-imposed comatose state. But we can, by right, only pass on what we can effectively defend and preserve here at home. And there's no better place to begin than by protecting and preserving the principle of separation of powers, so that it continues, not just as a safeguard of our individual liberties, but as an exemplar of democracy under the rule of law the world over. You will be about, in this next day or so, an examination of the particulars of what I have tried to sketch in broad outline here today. The contribution you can make will far transcend what is accomplished in this next day and a half. The opportunity for us to contribute to the rule of law worldwide is one that we must grasp and clasp to our breast if we want to see the rule of law and the respect and veneration of human rights spread across this globe at a time of maximum opportunity. Thank you all very much.
We have time for a few questions, and if people would please come to the microphones, we can call on you. Yep.
Yes. In your reference to the possibility of introducing some of these conceptions of law to Eastern Europe in particular, a number of people in Europe, in Western Europe, have criticized U.S. officials for advocating that Eastern European countries adopt the American conception of law, because they say that that would make it more difficult for these nations to ultimately integrate into the European community. And they say that instead, the Eastern European countries should adopt a European conception of law. What's the issue here as far as you see it, and do you think that there is a line that needs to be drawn to clarify a preference for the American legal system?
I think those concerns have a legitimate base. It's unthinkable to me that we would impose the template of our system on any developing nation as a necessary cure-all for their problems. It is equally unthinkable that we would forego the opportunity to introduce those essential elements of our system into the marketplace of ideas when it is in such ferment as it is in Eastern Europe. And one of the things that we learned during our encounter with the Soviets was an attitude on their part that they wanted to learn without being taught. The distinction is subtle, but nonetheless important in our relationships with these, we hope, developing democracies. And anything that we can do to expostulate upon our own experience and to share with the leadership and the thinkers and the framers, if you will, of these nascent constitutions, I think will be in our long-term interest. In many cases, we will be asked explicitly for the whole architectural designs. In other cases, the questions will, as they have, come in much more subtle ways. It is up to us as believers and salesmen of the concepts that have made our system unique to seize that opportunity in whatever way we can. I don't think we can lose by launching the ideas, that principles that underlie our system into that worldwide competition that's going to ensue inevitably during the next decade. Yes.
Mr. Thornburg, at our last conference, there was a lot of criticism about the RICO law, and that many felt that it allowed the government to seize property without due process. And also, there was some criticism about the drug laws on the same count. How do you reconcile those with your very well put comments that process is essential for defending freedom?
Well, let me speak with regard to the RICO laws at two levels. One, as tools in the aid of effective prosecutions of enterprises engaged in unlawful activity. They are a proper and powerful weapon, which I will defend and use judiciously when the occasion demands. I have considerable misgiving, as did my predecessors, and as we have expressed to the Congress, about posing and lodging that same authority in private hands without any ability, save in the courts, to regulate its use. We support proposals before the Congress at the present time that would restrict and inhibit the ability of private litigators to use the RICO statutes in many of the ways that they proved to be vexatious and troublesome in the history of that statute. With regard to the drug laws, I am not quite sure what your concern is there. If it is a concern that the existence of laws making the use of these substances unlawful is an infringement on individual liberties, I reject that notion categorically. The illegal use of drugs in this country, to the extent that it has taken hold in the last 20 years, poses a real threat to our national security. Poses a threat in the sense that it undermines important values upon which this nation has built and survived over the years. And the notion that we can legalize drug usage and pay the inevitable cost to our citizenry and to our society without eroding further important values in this country is, to me, absolutely and totally inadmissible. There is no country, no culture, no society in the history of mankind that has legalized drug use, prospered, and survived, period. And I reject that notion, as does the president, I'm pleased to say, and as I suspect to the overwhelming, if not almost total majority of the citizens of this country. Yes, sir.
Sir, my name is Tom Liddy. I'm from Fordham Law School. A few years ago, I cheered the Justice Department as they, with cunning, leased a yacht in the Mediterranean and brought it off the coast of Beirut and lured with wine, women, and song a terrorist, an American fugitive, and brought him on the ship and set sail off to international waters where the Justice Department was able to seize him and bring him to the United States to justice. And I'm wondering what happened between then and last December when we actually went down to Panama and captured General Noriega when we didn't need any cunning, we didn't need to lure him into international waters. Would you please explain to me what legal principle switched in those 2 years?
I don't think any legal principle switched. The apprehension of Fawaz Yunus was in accord with both our domestic and international law, as was the surrender of General Noriega to American officials incident to the president's lawful authority to protect American lives, to protect our treaty interests under the Panama Canal Treaty, and to take action that was designed to thwart the up to then successful efforts of General Noriega in overriding the expressed will of the electorate of Panama to instill a legitimate government. The apprehension of General Noriega was not the purpose of that action, but his surrender to American authorities was, I must admit, a welcome incident to that lawful action. And I think that we would come to a sorry pass indeed if we were to tolerate on a blanket basis wrongdoing that violated American criminal laws by anyone of any station in any country around the world. There may be, and there are, considerable difficulties in securing either extradition or surrender of individual defendants. We have a long list of our own. But when the opportunity presents itself for us to take lawful custody of those persons, we should not, on a blanket basis, forego that opportunity.
We've got time for one more question.
Over here, yes, sir.
My name is Irwin Caffey, and I'm a non-lawyer. I have strong opinions on the many issues that you've talked about this afternoon regarding the separation of powers. Would like to ask you the question why the Justice Department has not taken on the Congress in such items as the Boling Amendment over the years to the Supreme Court.
One of the difficulties in, quote, taking on, close quote, particular congressional actions is the difficulty in finding a proper case or controversy or other forum within which the issue can be joined. As you are well aware, I'm sure, we filed a brief on behalf of the administration in the case of United States versus Oliver North, which laid forth in great detail our analysis of the Boland Amendment and of the improprieties of the Congress in attempting to dictate by its over-participation in foreign policy matters the conduct of affairs which the Constitution directly allocates to the President of the United States. It is this President's desire and instruction to this Attorney General and to his counsel, Boyden Gray, and to the lawyers with whom we work, to search for apt opportunities and proper forum within which we may raise essential questions such as that that you refer to. It is not always easy for the reasons I indicated in my remarks, because the unconstitutional encroachments are often woven inextricably into measures that simply cannot be attacked frontally, lest a greater harm be done to our current day society. But that does not indicate an insensitivity to the issue or a lack of zeal in determining where those forums may exist. That quest will continue, that zeal will remain unabated, and my expectation is that sooner or later, many of these questions will arise in the process of a case or controversy upon which we will get a definitive and, I suggest, proper answer. Thank you for your patience and for your hospitality. I wish you a most successful session. Thank you. Thank you.